This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Heroin is back in the public spotlight. And it's not just the tragic death of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman, who died from an overdose earlier this week. It's also the rampant use of the drug in states like Vermont, where Governor Peter Shumlin used his State of the State address to call attention to the problem.
The facts speak for themselves. In Vermont since 2000, we've seen more than a 770% increase in treatment for all opiates. What started as an OxyContin and prescription drug addiction problem in Vermont has now grown into a full-blown heroin crisis. We've seen an over 250% increase in people receiving heroin treatment here in Vermont since 2000, with the greatest percentage increase, nearly 40%, in just the past year.
Here in Connecticut, the Torrington Register Citizen has been reporting on a growing crisis in that town, where 10 overdose deaths were reported last year. Across the nation, heroin use is on the rise. It's been increasingly problematic in northeastern states like ours. But why is heroin use becoming such an epidemic? We'll try to answer that question and look at the science of heroin addiction. We'll talk about some of the treatment options also available to addicts. We want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Has heroin or heroin addiction touched your life? You can email us wherewelive@wnpr.org. You can tweet us at wherewelive. We want to welcome back to the show Dr. Sarita Rao, who's a chairman and director of behavioral health services at St. Francis Hospital, our neighbor here in the Asylum Hill neighborhood of Hartford. And it's very good to see you once again. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I also want to welcome in by phone Dr. Melinda Campopiano, who's a medical officer at the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration. Thank you very much, doctor, for being here as well.
My pleasure.
Dr. Rao, I'll start with you. When we hear about increased heroin use, not only here, but throughout the Northeast and across the United States, what's driving this, do you think?
Well, some of it is simply availability. You know, I think if you think about the trade routes of heroin, a lot of it comes, you know, from, let's say, a place like Afghanistan, and then it just gets moved along the land routes through Europe or, you know, Africa, and it hits the Northeast. So some of it is just availability, and some of it is that it is a highly addictive drug. And the third thing, which the governor of Vermont, you know, really touched upon, I loved what he said, was sad but true, is that we have an absolute epidemic of prescription opiate use in the United States. Some statistics show that we use 80% of the world's narcotic prescriptions here in the U.S. And the second country to use it is Canada.
And that's when you say use, is that use and abuse or use even just to treat some sort of a pain problem?
Essentially,
we're just using it more than anybody else.
Exactly. And that really asks the question. I mean, you could say that in developing countries, you know, people don't have access to health care, you know, maybe in Asia, Latin America, Africa. But what about Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Japan? Why aren't they in so much pain?
We're going to try to talk a bit more about that and some of the connections. As we've talked about on the program before, I think it's an important connection between opiates like OxyContin and heroin. But Dr. Campopiano, I'm wondering if you can maybe give us some statistics. The governor talks about the problem in Vermont. We read the anecdotal problems in towns like Torrington or elsewhere in Connecticut. What are the current national statistics and trends around heroin use?
Well, by and large, the number of individuals who report either past month or past year heroin use has approximately doubled since 2007, when you compare it to the 2012 data that we have. That's the most recent. Opioid analgesic use and misuse and accidental overdoses related to them remains a much, much bigger problem than problems related to heroin. But obviously, there's concern for that portion of people who will transition from opioid analgesics, like the OxyContin and so on, over to heroin when these medications are no longer available to them. And we're beginning to see that happening a little bit in some parts of the country where prescribing practices have started to change a little bit so that doctors are less readily prescribing opioid pain relievers. and where significant legal actions have been taken to reduce the availability of opioid analgesics for illegal purposes through, for example, illicit pill mills and things like that.
When it comes to heroin use specifically, how does Connecticut stack up? Are we essentially mirroring any national trends? Is it worse here than anyplace else?
Well, by and large, the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic areas are unfortunately leading this particular curve. But no part of the nation is spared. New Mexico, for example, which feels about as far away from Connecticut, especially this time of year, as you can get, has a really huge public health crisis on their hands with regard to heroin use, opioid analgesic use, and related fatalities.
When we talk about raw numbers, can you give us an idea of how many people use heroin on a regular basis across the United States? I mean, what's the number there?
Well, we know that from the 2012 data that 669,000 people reported having used heroin in the last year. About half that number reported past month use. Now, this is a self-report survey done of households, and it's only a sample of the population, but that gives you an approximate idea. Any use of opioids, for example, even a person who takes a pain medication as prescribed for as little as 2 weeks, can lead to dependence. So that people are reporting any heroin use at all is a concern for the development of dependence, meaning regular use that's driven by having to avoid withdrawal in that person.
And we're going to go ahead. Yes.
Sorry. We also know that about 25% of treatment admissions, these are two licensed programs that we survey on the federal level, that 25% of treatment admissions are related to opioid misuse disorders. And that's a really large percentage compared to the portion of the population that has problems with opioids. For example, marijuana misuses are still our leading illicit drug of misuse, marijuana is. But we're seeing a quarter of treatment admissions related to opioids.
In a bit, I think a few things that we want to tackle on our program today is we want to talk about marijuana, in part because it seems as though there's dueling national conversations about two drugs. One, heroin, seen as very scary, very dangerous, and out of control. Marijuana is one that's gaining legal acceptance in many states currently. So we'll talk about that in a moment. We're also going to get some phone calls at 860-275-7266 as we talk about heroin and some of the science of addiction here on our program. We're hearing on the phone Dr. Melinda Campopiano, who is from the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration. Dr. Sarita Rao is here from St. Francis Hospital. Let's go to Lancia, I believe it is, from Hamden. Hi there. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Thanks. I'm a mental health professional in Hamden, Bridgeport, actually. And I just wanted to comment that I'm seeing an overabundance of pain medications being overprescribed to clients who are saying, I have this pain. I don't really want to take all this medication for, you know, work and children and whatnot. But they're feeling a lot of pressure from their pain professional, I forget what they're exactly called, to take the medication. And then there comes a point where they say, okay, yeah, no more. We're cutting you off. And so I think that then oftentimes leads to someone finding their own resources to manage their pain.
Mm. Alancia, thank you very much for that. Maybe you can talk about that, Dr. Rao, a little bit about the connections between these two things. We've spoken about it briefly, but just help us understand about how an opioid painkiller, something that someone may rely on for severe back pain, say, then they become perhaps addicted to, and how that may chemically lead them toward a life of heroin addiction.
Well, if you look at the brain and you look at our natural opioid receptors in the brain, there are many different kinds of opioid receptors. But if you look at the mu receptor, that's the receptor that mediates pain control and also euphoria and is responsible for, you know, a lot of the addiction and physical dependence. So, you know, as a society, we have to look at it not just as a medical issue, but as a societal issue where why are we as a society relying more and more heavily on narcotics? So if you look at ancient human history, you know, heroin is made from the poppy plant. And just like alcohol, in small doses, a lot of these natural drugs are medication, and in larger doses, they're poison. So in ancient times, people did pain relief through morphine. And even today in our modern day world, we do pain relief for, you know, dying cancer patients through morphine. So if you or a loved one was dying of cancer, you would want that morphine to, you know, spare you the pain. On the other hand, there's been an absolute epidemic, as the governor of Vermont mentioned, of people getting opiate narcotic prescriptions for non-malignant pain, that they're maintained on this for back pain, even migraine headaches. I'm seeing this. So there's a fine line between treatment for pain, which is legitimate, and then the person becoming very dependent on these drugs just to get through their day-to-day life. Because the way any opiate, whether it's a synthetic opiate made in a lab or a natural opiate like heroin or morphine, the way it relieves pain is not the same way as something like Tylenol. It's very different. It basically, you have the pain, your leg could be broken, and your brain just ignores the pain. So if your brain is ignoring this much physical pain, you could imagine how much emotional pain it can ignore. And you never know, whenever somebody is trying any kind of drug, you never know whether you're going to become addicted, because if your brain is vulnerable to addiction, either because of genetics or simply because it's more vulnerable, and we can talk about the neurobiology later in the show, then you could become addicted to it. And it's not because you're a weak person. It's simply because your brain is different.
And one of the things we've read in preparing for the show, the accounts of people who've spent time addicted to heroin, they come to realize after they stop that what the drug actually does, and the drug isn't really the problem. They have a problem themselves.
Exactly.
The drug helps to mask. It helps to mask this pain, whether it's emotional, psychological, or physical, and the drug is something they need over time in order to do that. So to talk about that piece of addiction, if you would, as opposed to what we'll call one-time use. When we're looking at the statistics of people who are using heroin maybe for the first time, it seems as though a lot of these big numbers must be people doing this one time or a few times over the course of their lives. What's the difference between someone who does it once and someone who then becomes addicted to it? How's that different?
Well, you know, addiction is one of the most hardwired brain diseases there is. But socially, we don't think of it that way because people still think of it as strength and weakness. There's a lot of morality issues that society brings up. But it's as hardwired as schizophrenia. So we have the mesolimbic pathway in our brain. And when we say pathway, it's basically like a bundle of nerves, you know, running through parts of your brain that produce similar neurotransmitters, which are natural chemicals that our brain uses, one nerve uses to talk to another. So dopamine is, this mesolimbic pathway is a dopaminergic pathway. And dopamine is the reward and reinforcement neurotransmitter of our brains. It mediates a lot of drive behaviors like food and sex. So you need food for the organism to stay alive, and you need sex for the species to stay alive. Without that, we'd all be dead. So, but any kind of drug of addiction, whether it's nicotine, alcohol, cocaine, heroin, the brain doesn't distinguish between a legal drug, an illegal drug, prescribed drug, something bought on the street. The brain can't tell the difference. For people who are vulnerable to developing addiction, you know, substance use disorders, their brain is completely hijacked by these drugs. If they use it long enough, and sometimes it's only a few times, depending on how vulnerable they are, then their brain is completely hijacked, and the brain believes that this drug is more important than anything else, more important than your family, job, you know, eating. You see the average person addicted to heroin or, you know, coming in off the street, they're often like really thin, you know. And so it's basically your brain is hijacked. And the higher centers of the brain, like the cortex or the frontal lobes that are responsible for logic, self-control, reasonable thought, they're overridden by this mesolimbic pathway.
And in this way, Dr. Campopiano, it seems that many people who believe that this is a drug that they can use recreationally or whether they think they can use it to solve a short-term problem in their lives, this brain hijacking that Dr. Rao is talking about is something that's going on that they don't necessarily perceive. Is that right?
That's correct. In addition, with the opioids, they bind your opioid receptors, which then become dependent on that stimulus so that you become physically dependent on the presence of those opioids in order to just feel normal, aside from feeling good or feeling pain relief or feeling euphoria. So the opioids are of special concern because they have that additional mechanism on top of what Dr. Rao described as the basic mechanisms of the development of addiction. Unfortunately, you know, in addition to the genetic component, people with mental health issues who are suffering emotional pain are at higher risk of developing dependence and misuse problems with opioids. So anxiety, depression is a risk factor. Trauma is another risk factor. And so these are things that can be acquired throughout life, so your risk can change a little bit. I do want to say, however, that it according to some data we published late last year, they estimate a little under 4% of people who misuse pain relievers, who are using them non-medically, go on to use heroin within 5 years. So while it's true some people who are given opioid analgesics for pain relief, for you know, some workplace injury or something like that, if they discontinue that medication, suddenly they'll go into withdrawal. But they're not. I don't want people to think that they can't safely take pain medication. It does need to be supervised carefully with a responsible prescriber. But it's not that people need to just suffer their pain. In the world that we live in today, there isn't a lot of slack for people to, you know, take time off, rest up. You know, physical therapy costs another copay. You know, other alternative therapies for pain aren't covered by insurance. So the world we live in today is that applies a lot of pressure to people to continue to function on a very high level, and that contributes to the perceived need to get pain relief so that you can continue functioning at your previous level. And a lot of people who are coping with emotional pain turn to drugs to do that. It's really not any different from how people use alcohol, for example, for stress relief and so on.
We're talking with Dr. Melinda Campopiano, who is from the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration. Joining us in studio today is Dr. Sarita Rao, who's Chairman and Director of Behavioral Health Services at St. Francis Hospital here in Hartford. We're talking about heroin and heroin addiction on our program today. If you have been touched by this or you have questions about heroin, 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. You can also send us a tweet at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about some of the science behind heroin addiction, a huge problem in Connecticut and a growing problem throughout the Northeast and America. We're going to be discussing some of the treatment options available to heroin addicts coming up in just a bit. We're also taking your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Here's Matilda calling from Washington. Hello, Matilda.
Hi, John. Hi. I just have a short comment, and I think it might be good to look at what people are seeing as their inspiration for using heroin or for a lot of the behaviors that we see today, which are so negative for society. And I think that a lot of TV and movies and especially video games use violence and negative sex and drug use to attract us. They give you that little jolt of, you know, brain chemistry, that's excitement, but at the cost of spreading knowledge and spreading, it's almost like when you see it on the television or you see it happening in a movie that you think, oh, well, that's pretty normal. I guess I'll go do that. I would like to be part of that. And it really degrades the whole society. People are just making a lot of money selling us bad things.
Matilda, first of all, thank you very much for your phone call. I really appreciate it. And, you know, we were struggling with how we wanted to frame this program, Dr. Rao, because obviously a lot of us admired the work of Philip Seymour Hoffman. He's not the only famous actor or entertainer who's died in this way. That said, last year, as I talked about in the introduction to our program earlier, we lost the great singer-songwriter Lou Reed, someone whose music I adored. He wrote a lot about heroin. He wrote a lot about drug use. And in many ways, his music and his lifestyle glamorized something that is indeed very dark and very, very dangerous. To Matilda's point, do you think that there's some of that in here? It's not just about overprescription of opioids and people then getting hooked. It's not just about easy availability, but it's also about the way we treat it in society. What do you think?
Yes, no, I agree. And I think if you look at the, I agree with Matilda's remarks as well. We have to be very cautious. What kind of message are we sending our most impressionable citizens, our preteens, teens, about any drug, you know? But you know, a lot of creative, a lot of people who are very creative, musicians, artists, you know, throughout the centuries, it's, we don't know exactly why, but, you know, their brain is a little different from someone who, let's say, is much more, you know, black and white in their thinking. And maybe along with that comes a certain amount of, like, existential angst, which can lead to, you know, dark moods or a little bit of experimentation or a lot of experimentation with the dark side. And one thing that people don't talk about is because it can sound like, you know, it's okay. But the truth is that of all the drugs that we have today, you know, legal drugs, illegal drugs, heroin is not really neurotoxic, meaning it doesn't kill brain cells. So you could be a jazz musician and you could use heroin your whole life and it's not going to affect your intelligence, your cognitive abilities, your creativity. But you could die of an overdose. You could die of terrible infections from, you know, sharing needles. You could, you know, be a slave to the drug, but your music could still continue really well. And people can sometimes not tell that difference. Whereas alcohol, you can't really use it in an alcoholic manner and still maintain your cognitive abilities, your ability to function, all of that sort of stuff.
A bit later, we're going to be talking more about help for people who are addicted to heroin. But beyond the addiction, can you just talk briefly, Dr. Rao, about overdose? I mean, what exactly happens there? We hear about sometimes a certain strain of a drug being very, very powerful, and that's what causes an overdose. Or misuse of a drug, using too much of it at a single time. Just give us an example of what happens in an overdose death, because we've been hearing about so many of them here in Connecticut and nationwide.
The simplest way to explain it is that basically with any kind of opiate, whether it's a prescription opiate that you're overusing or, you know, mixing with alcohol or mixing with something like tranquilizers like Xanax, Valium, you know, Klonopin, Ativan, or it's heroin bought on the street, an opiate in human beings, basically at some point you go past the euphoria and you stop breathing and die. It's a central nervous system depressant, which means it depresses a lot of areas of your brain and ultimately depresses parts of the brain that are responsible for, you know, respiration, and you basically stop breathing and die. But it can happen very quickly. People who are addicted to things always feel they can titrate the dose. They know exactly how many OxyContins to take, how many bags of heroin to take. But the heroin that's available today for many years now, especially in the Northeast, is increasingly purer, which means it's stronger, more addictive, and more likely to kill you suddenly.
And the difference between somebody who uses it intravenously and somebody who maybe snorts it or ingests it in some other way, is there a huge difference in the way it's delivered to your body?
Yes, yes, definitely. That's a really good question. So with any drug, the fastest way to get it to your brain, the most addictive, the most euphoric, is smoking or shooting it up, so intravenous use. When you put a needle into your arm, you know, it goes quickly to your heart and then from there to the brain. When you smoke something, let's say cigarettes or heroin, which is sometimes smoked, rarely, but it's done, there's a huge surface area in your lungs, so you breathe it in, all that surface area, the blood vessels, they absorb the drug and send it to the brain. So it's a very sharp uptick and then a sharp crash when you're coming off of it. And that can lead to addiction and also a sharper high.
I want to get to some phone calls here at 860-275-7266. Tony is calling from New Haven. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you today?
Doing okay.
As I spoke to the lady before on the phone, I was just telling her, for me, I'm a recovering addict, and for me, it was I had severe accident and several surgeries and a long opiate dependence through, you know, through the doctors. And then as that ended, as it, what it really came down to for me, just because I felt like I could not live without it because of the sickness and all those things, what happens is the cost of the prescriptions on the street is so much higher than the heroin. The heroin is so literally inexpensive. I mean, probably one-third to one-fourth of the cost of the of buying pills, prescription pills on the street, so to speak, illegally. The heroin is one-fourth the cost, so that's how the progression ends up there. And I and it comes to a point where you really almost don't even feel like it, it's almost a way of life. You're not even really, it's not even illegal to you. It's simply what you have to do. And like she said, I think people are predisposed. I know that for me, it seemed like other people that were going through the same thing as me in the treatment, you know, the pain management clinic and stuff, weren't as susceptible. It seemed like I was immediately just in need of this on a higher level, and my escalation seemed a lot more rapid than other people. And even the doctors noticed, but it didn't stop it because I obviously needed those pain pills at that time. But that's just for me. I'm just saying, I think it really comes down to cost is why people are switching to heroin instead of seeking out the pills.
Tony, can I ask you, how did you get on the road to recovery?
Well, out of necessity, really. It's you lose everything. I mean, you basically stop eating, you stop everything in your, like she said, the frontal lobe problem or whatever you want to call it.
But I'll ask it a different way. I mean, did you seek specific professional help? Were you taking something to curb the addiction? Did you just stop taking? Maybe you can just explain for our listeners how you got on the road to recovery. Personally,
well, numerous in and out of numerous rehabs over years, from my first opioid addiction, which was when I was like 35. I'm 50 now, and I certainly didn't get it at the first time because, you know, you every time you get a little pain, you immediately your mind starts taking over and telling you, "I need this. I got to have it," and you justify it. And the reality is that most of the time you don't, but it's like your brain lies to you. And then, yes, I eventually, through 12-step help and through people and just really it gets to a point where you just literally, it's either function or die, you know. And so I myself just had to stop. I mean, physically, I mean, there's a lot of liver issues and all kinds of things as a result of long-term use and abuse. And basically, for me, it was a necessity. It was either stop or die. But if I could have remained healthy and continued to use, I have to be honest, I probably would still be doing it.
Well, and first of all, Tony, thank you very much for sharing your story. I think it's very important for people to hear, and I appreciate you calling very much. And that is something we have heard before, people actually literally saying you can be well and use up until a certain point, and that's why many people have this long-term problem. Lou is calling from Hamden. Hello, Lou. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that our culture has a tendency to do is really to try to separate illicit drug use from prescription drug use. We kind of look at the two differently. Our criminal justice system deals with the two in very different ways. But I think that they are all part of a kind of underlying drug problem that our culture has. And I think that that stems all the way up to the healthcare institution as well. There's a lot of pressure from pharmaceutical companies for doctors to prescribe. Doctors are also under a lot of pressure from their clients and their patients to overprescribe. And knowing what we know about the correlation between prescription drug use and heroin use and abuse and all these kinds of things, I think it's important for us to take a step back and to look at the bigger picture.
Lou, thank you very much for your phone call. And Dr. Campopiano, listening down the line, if you heard what Lou said, I mean, he's essentially making the case that I think we've already been talking about a bit, that we shouldn't have this bright line between illegal drug use and legal drug use. Do you agree with what he's saying?
Well, that may be so. And I think that partly what needs to happen is the information that people need to be able to reduce their risk of dying, and the access to treatment needs to be increased. This a very rational public health approach needs to be applied here, so that people who need treatment are not kept from getting it because it's not covered by their insurance, it's not available in their community, or they are too ashamed to get it. When people can also, with the right information, such as SAMHSA makes available through our opioid overdose toolkit, they can actually control their risk factors to some extent, such as, you know, not using other substances, making sure the consistency of what they're using is good through testing it and so on, but also by having naloxone available. Naloxone is the antidote to opioid overdose, and this is becoming more widely available and can be prescribed by physicians. People need those tools because this is what's going on in our world, and this is what's happening, and people are dying, and they're dying tragically. You know, mothers, brothers, parents, kids, they're dying, and they're dying alone, partly because of the shame of addiction and the way that that prevents people from getting information and getting treatment.
It's about shame and it's about stigma, but it's also about having the right tools. We got a tweet, actually, from one of our listeners who asks why naloxone isn't more widely available, Dr. Alb, for use by doctors and also by first responders. If indeed this is something that can help in an overdose situation, why isn't it more widely available?
Well, a lot of people don't know about it. And, you know, people in society in general, I think, have a lot of morality-related thoughts. It really should be treated like a public health issue, and SAMHSA does a lot of, education about it. So as Dr. Campopiano just talked about, I mean, she made some really good points. And but, you know, it's in some states, like Rhode Island, I just read yesterday that one of my physician colleagues from Rhode Island sent this out, who's also an addiction specialist. In Rhode Island, a person can walk into a pharmacy, ask for an naloxone prescription. They contact a set of doctors, and if it's written, it's given to the patient. Or they've made it somehow simpler. I couldn't quite figure out all the details. But the truth is, if you are, you know, getting high off of heroin, maybe you've thrown in some other substances in there, you're no longer in a rational state of mind. You may use that naloxone, and it might save your life, or somebody in your family might use it, or you just somehow don't even realize and you slip away into death.
Can I just ask you quickly about the thing that we wanted to get to? Our caller brought up this issue about the way we view drugs in society, and even just talking about this stigma or morality question, I want to get to that question about marijuana use. We seem to be, as I said before, moving down parallel tracks that are veering off in different ways here. One having to do with the fear of something like heroin, and the opioids that are prescription drugs. And then on the other side, we seem to have a much more tolerant view of a drug called marijuana. This is not to get into the pros and cons of these various substances, but maybe you can just explain, Dr. Rao, how substantially different are they? And when we talk about something like marijuana being a gateway drug, something that might lead to a harder drug usage down the road, is there any reality or truth to that?
Well, there is reality, a lot of reality. Marijuana is the gateway drug for a lot of our adolescents, and we have to treat it with much more fear and respect than we do. But you're right. I mean, people have this perception between soft drugs and hard drugs, what they call soft and hard, between legal, illegal, prescribed, non-prescribed. But to the brain, it's all pretty similar. The brain doesn't distinguish where the drug came from. It's just getting an effect. But I think we have to distinguish between legalization, medicalization, and decriminalization. So a lot of our young people who are, you know, arrested because they're arrested for possession or possession, if they have a certain amount, I don't know what it is exactly, I can never keep track of it, intent to sell, especially if they're from inner city or somewhat economically depressed towns versus a more upscale town, you know, they could go off to prison at very young ages. They could get felonies on their records, and it just wrecks their whole life. So at that point, we're not talking about legalization. We're just talking about they need to be diverted. And some of this is done in Connecticut through various programs like JDSA, where people are diverted, if they haven't committed a violent crime, into treatment instead of... So there's that whole issue. But I think to a lot of the lay public, When something is smoked, they perceive it as less risky than when it's shot up, used intravenously. But if there's one thing I would say on the show, there's a reason why cigarette companies market cigarettes smoking. Smoking gets the drug to your brain as quickly as using it IV.
And it is noteworthy today that just yesterday we hear that the giant drug company CVS, which
yes.
has locations all over New England and all over America, they've stopped selling cigarettes in part because they want to be seen as more of a health delivery company as opposed to just a place to buy stuff. Dr. Campobiano, before I let you go, you know, we got a tweet here that says, any chance of a discussion about the harsh punishment of drug users by the justice system and disregard for treatment? That's one thing we can get into. But I guess I'm just wondering from your standpoint at the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, how are you tackling this issue of sort of hard drugs versus soft drugs, about America's, you know, overwhelming addiction in many ways to something like alcohol, but then our fear and our misunderstanding of something like heroin? How are you dealing with these sort of changing paradigms right now?
Well, in a sense, we take a medical public health approach, and we always have. A drug may be moved from one side of the line to the other as far as how society perceives it. But when people are dependent on substances and it's impeding their progress in life or causing them suffering, it needs to be dealt with as a medical psychiatric problem. And because of that, we promote access to treatment. And in the case of opiate addiction, access to medication-assisted treatment is particularly important. You know, methadone's not popular, but methadone saves lives. Methadone reduces the transmission of HIV. Buprenorphine, they published something in Baltimore just late last year showing the decrease in fatal overdoses associated with the increased availability of methadone and buprenorphine in Baltimore. There's also extended-release injectable naltrexone, which is not a controlled substance, not abusable, works for about a month. So these therapies need to be out there, and the people in our communities who are responsible for the public health, including individual physicians, need to be providing, not just promoting, but providing these therapies.
Dr. Melinda Campobiano is medical officer for the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment at the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration. We'll put out more information about how you can find out more info from them on our website, WNPR.org. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us. I truly appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
When we come back, we're going to talk more about how to get treatment for people that you know or love who might be addicted to heroin. We're going to continue with Dr. Sarita Rao from St. Francis Hospital as well. We'll take your calls at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's program, the U.S. and Pakistan have a long history of strained political relations. Former Pakistani Ambassador Hussein Haqqani has been writing about this. He attributes it to decades of misunderstanding. We'll be talking about Pakistan and the U.S. coming up on tomorrow's show. And I hope you can join me tomorrow afternoon from 2 to 4 as I host Science Friday, sitting in for Ira Flatter. We'll be talking about a number of science-related topics, including talking with the magician Teller about his new movie called Tim's Vermeer. That's coming up tomorrow afternoon on Science Friday. Today in the program, we're talking about heroin and heroin addiction. Our guest in studio is Dr. Sarita Rao, who's chairman and director of behavioral health services at St. Francis Hospital, our neighbor right here in Hartford. I want to welcome in Dr. Suzanne Duquette, who's chief of medical staff at Hartford Dispensary. Dr. Duquette, thank you so much for being here on Where We Live. I appreciate your time.
Sure. I'm happy to be here.
I want to get through a number of different phone calls because people have questions. But very quickly, Dr. Duquette, talk about some of the treatment options available to heroin addicts. We just talked before the break about a few of the drug treatments, but talk a bit more broadly about how people can get treatment if they need it.
Well, one of the methods that people can engage in is outpatient treatment that is provided by the Hartford Dispensary and other clinics like it. The patient just needs to present to one of our clinics. We have 8 different clinics around the state, and then there are other outpatient treatment clinics that provide medication-assisted therapy throughout Connecticut, and just provide evidence of your identification and that you are in need of help, and then we very quickly can enroll people in the program to have medication-assisted therapy with methadone that also includes group and individual counseling, case management. We have life coaches. We have a lot of services that we provide to the patients to help them resolve the life problems that they have along with their addiction. And I'm sure Dr. Rao has already talked about some of the inpatient treatments that are available as she is the director at ADRC.
I want to get to a few emails and questions people have coming in. Jessica from Fairfield wants to ask about Iboga or Ibogaine as a treatment for opiate addiction. It works on transmitters, she writes, and this is one of a few different emails we've gotten about this. Blocks opiate receptors, completely eliminates withdrawal symptoms, and removes physical cravings. Withdrawal is the reason, she writes, so many addicts can't kick. It's brutal. I'm 19 years sober and only know the 12-step recovery model, sometimes coupled with Suboxone or methadone, both of which are also addiction and require difficult withdrawal. I only learned about Iboga in the wake of Philip Seymour Hoffman's death, and I'm blown away by its efficacy. Can you tell us anything more about that, Dr. Duquette?
I personally don't know anything about that particular medication. I'm sure we could research it. I don't know if Dr. Rao has any information on it. But right now, the gold standard for treatment is methadone, and that then buprenorphine is a newer medication that has been approved by the FDA for the treatment of opiate addiction.
Okay.
I've heard of it, but it's not mainstream treatment, and really opiate withdrawal is very unpleasant. The person feels like they're dying. It's like having the stomach flu combined with the upper respiratory flu at the same time. So, and people who become addicted to opiates are terrified of the withdrawal. It's not life-threatening the way alcohol withdrawal or coming off barbiturates or benzodiazepines is, but you feel like you're dying, unless you're very immunocompromised or frail. You know, you're not going to die. But so you have two options. You can go check into a detoxification program, and Connecticut is a state that's pretty rich in treatment resources. So you can do that, and then you have to follow up with either outpatient therapy or residential treatment, go to Narcotics Anonymous. Sometimes people go to Alcoholics Anonymous, actually. 12-step programs, get a sponsor, do the whole bit. And your other option is, let's say you're so terrified of the withdrawal that you just can't imagine going through it, or you have to be honest with yourself, you're really not ready to live life without opiates. You can't imagine it. It's too scary. Then I would say then you sign on for opioid agonist maintenance therapies like methadone maintenance or buprenorphine, which is also known as Suboxone. You know, these two drugs are opiates, but they're long-acting, and they basically treat your drug hunger, your withdrawal. You don't get the ups and downs, and you get all these other wraparound treatments that the places like the Hartford Dispensary are providing, you know, therapy, counseling.
And that's a big piece of it. As you say, wraparound services, it's not just handing out something to help cure withdrawal symptoms. It actually really allows you to get better along the way because you have more help and support services. A lot of people want to join us, so let's quickly go through a few phone calls. Lisa's in Middletown. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I'm raising a granddaughter. Her parents are both in treatment right now, and they have been off and on for one is for opiate addiction and one is for alcoholism, and they both have mental health diagnoses. And I'm just very concerned about this child and whether there are anything I could do, I guess, to look for or avoid any kind of, or I guess basically look for anything that would look, look like addiction tendencies, I guess, in a child this young and what I can do as she gets older.
Well, first of all, a great question. And maybe, Dr. Rao, just a quick answer to that, because I also want to get into if you have someone who's a young person who's addicted, where do they go? What do they do? But go ahead.
Well, I mean, there's no hard and fast, you know, signs of addiction. There are some very intelligent children whose grades don't even suffer, you know. But any kind of behavioral change. But I think this is a really good point, is that you have two parents, heavy genetic loading. It's like having two parents with severe heart disease. Mm. You can't be the person that's carrying 20 extra pounds and eating butter and pies. Do you know what I mean? So in this case, education is really important for this child to say, don't experiment with things, because given our family history, you're more likely than not to get addicted to them, to get hooked to them. And also to be cautious, because if this child develops any kind of mental health issues, to be really careful about what medications are prescribed, to ask questions, is this medication addictive? And to get the kid counseling, even for the fact that the parents are gone.
Dr. Duquette, any thoughts about if people have fears about their children being addicted to drugs or being even involved in heroin? What's the thing that you do differently maybe with a teenager than an adult who's been using for some time?
Well, I think one of the things is really open lines of communication. Teenagers tend to try to maintain their privacy and respond more likely to their peer groups than to their parents sometimes. So you really have to have very, very good, open, clear lines of communication starting as young as possible, talking about all of these difficult topics from the very beginning so that the child has access to the parents' level of knowledge and not just what the peer group is telling them. And then there are specific services that children and adolescents can access through Connecticut Valley Hospital and through the Department of Children and Family.
Let's go to Emily quickly. Emily in North Haven, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I know a few people indirectly that are addicted, and I'm watching their families kind of deal with it, and it seems to always be oscillating between really supportive and tough love, and none of them seem effective. So I just wanted to know if you can comment on that, on kind of the best way to be a support for if you know somebody.
A great question. Dr. Rao, go ahead.
Well, addiction's a family disease. You know, it affects the family as much as it affects the person. Particularly for parents, it's a huge dilemma. You know, I always say to parents, you have to draw your own line in the sand because unlike a spouse, you can't really walk away from your child. So if whatever decision you make at this point, you can't live in the house anymore, you have to be able to live with it if something really bad happens, like an overdose death. So I always say, you know, draw that line of tough love where you feel comfortable. But I think I would always encourage the family to get therapy for themselves and to go to Al-Anon or Nar-Anon meetings, which are 12-step meetings for loved ones of people with substance abuse problems.
I think a big part of this is, and you mentioned this before, it's this problem of we believe in our society that this is something that is by choice. And because it's by choice, we can choose to then stop. And that's part of the stigma. It's part of the misconception. Once you start, you may not be able to stop. And so drawing that line, I think, for people who don't have the addiction themselves may be very difficult.
It may be very difficult because, and the simplest way I explain it when I teach medical students or residents, which I did this week, is I say to them, look, they can't, you know, they're like, why can't they just stop? Well, if you look at sugar and refined carbohydrates, they're not really foods. They're just treaty foods. You know, they're like foods that are rewarding and reinforcing. They do similar things in our brain as many drugs. What if the rest of us had to live our entire life without ever eating sugar or a refined carbohydrate again? Could we do it?
Dr. Duquette, we just have less than a minute left, but I'd like you to weigh in on that idea about how you either confront or you console, you deal with someone who you love who has this problem.
Well, I can tell you the most difficult problem that I see in my practice is when the patient's family is against them getting medication-assisted treatment. It really is a very effective treatment for opiate addiction, and I think the most challenging thing for a lot of our patients is just the stigma attached to it, not only by the public, but by their own families. Patients here actually hide that they're in treatment from their families when the family should actually be supporting them getting help.
Dr. Suzanne Duquette is Chief of Medical Staff at Hartford Dispensary. Thank you very much for your time. I truly appreciate it.
All right, no problem. Thank you.
I also want to thank Dr. Sarita Rao, who's Chairman and Director of Behavioral Health Services at St. Francis Hospital. Thank you for coming in. Thanks for your expertise.
I was glad to be here.
A lot of people want to continue this conversation. We just didn't have enough time for everyone. So go online to WNPR.org. Throughout the day, we'll be updating our program, and you can add your comments. We'll try to answer and get as many answers to you as well, and we will continue a conversation about this. Our own Lucy Nalpathanchil is doing some reporting about heroin in our communities, and we want to continue this conversation here on WNPR and Where We Live. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.